Welcome to the Resistance Roundtable, which comes to you the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m., and where we consider the increasingly frightening assaults on democracy under the regime of Donald the John Trump. There's been a lot of media speculation about the wheels flying off the Trump wagon, what with his emergence as the super spreader in chief, his increasingly erratic behavior and pronouncements, and the apparent panic among some Senate Republicans as they run for their political lives in competitive races around the country. The mainstream media has sent out a team of forensic pundits to pore over the video of Mitch McConnell hinting that he disapproves of Trump's reckless behavior on COVID in the White House and beyond. It does seem that these Trump toadies are beginning to smell the stench of the Trump sewage that they are now standing in up to their ankles.
I like that, Richard.
And we'll be addressing these and other issues during this hour with our regular panel, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, who teaches English at Central Connecticut State University and is active in the American Association of University Professors. She's also directed plays for the Westport Community Theater, and we hope that she'll be back at it sooner than later. Scott Harris is the host of Counterpoint, a public affairs show that airs every Monday at 8 p.m. on this station. He's also the executive producer of Between the Lines News Magazine, a nationally syndicated show that also airs here on WPKN twice a week. I host First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio, the Organic Farm Stand, and I'm on the roster of hosts for the public issues show Mic Check, which airs every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. And this week we'll be joined by a guest on the phone, Shira Tarantino, who is the co-organizer of the October 17th Stanford Women's March to Save Democracy. We'll be hearing a lot about that in that conversation with Shira coming up 15 minutes from now or so. But before we welcome our guest, let's check in with our panel to highlight some of the alarming developments of the past couple of weeks. Ruth Ann, who's on the phone, what are some of the things you've been thinking about? What say you on this, actually, our last show before the election?
Oh, wow, that's portentous, isn't it? Well, what I have to say is kind of a sidestep. It's an issue that should it should be very important to us, and it's certainly very important to me, and it has breaking news associated with it. I'm hoping that after the election it will no longer be an issue because the man will be gone, but this is what I have to say about it now. Like the coronavirus itself, Donald Trump invades organ after organ, system after system, usurping it, making it his own, and corrupting or killing it. In this sense, anyway, there seems to be no end to his energy and malicious appetite. One of those organs is our country's effort to understand and honor our diversity. We see steps in this direction in our courts, our neighborhoods, our demonstrations, our elections, and our schools, the latest target of his personal white power crusade. According to Colleen Flaherty, writing in the October 7 Inside Higher Education, some institutions have begun to cancel diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in response to a Trump executive order against divisive concepts in federally funded programs. Flaherty's article, Diversity Work Interrupted, begins with the latest news. Two campuses are halting diversity efforts in relation to the White House's recent executive order against divisive concepts in federally funded programs. Although the University of Iowa's interim executive vice president for diversity, equality, and inclusion, and the university continues to value these concepts, in the face of Trump's threat to withhold federal funding, she called for a temporary two-week halt in all diversity programs there. John A. Logan College in Illinois also suspended diversity efforts, including a planned Hispanic Heritage Month lecture. Trump's executive order, issued September 22nd, identifies diversity programs as reflective of an ideology that Trump's favorite authority, many people, views as pernicious and false, grounded in hierarchies based on collective social and political identities, rather than in the inherent and equal dignity of every person as an individual. This would be American history programs. Such an ideology, the order claims, is rooted in the pernicious and false belief that America is an irredeemably racist and sexist country, that some people simply on account of their race or sex are oppressors, and that racial and sexual identities are more important than our common status as human beings and Americans. Therefore, according to Flaherty, the order prohibits the promotion of race or sex stereotyping or scapegoating, well, I would hope so, in the federal workforce or in the uniformed services. Federal contractors also will not be permitted to inculcate such views in their employees, and grant funds will not be used for such purposes. The problem with the order is its vagueness and the fact that in various places where it defines these bad things that are being taught, it's flipping the definition and attributing it in the wrong place. The order prohibits the study or teaching of concepts that it first misrepresents. Flaherty says further that actor and playwright William Jackson Harper has said that the order threatens arts-based work he's doing with U.S. military academies. Harper wrote that the film Malcolm X, for example, is history. American history is not propaganda meant to teach one to favor one race or sex over the other. It's history. It's an admittedly thorny history, but it is history. Furthermore, because the order talks about federal employees, agencies, and contractors, there's been confusion as to its scope. Its provisions may be read as applicable to all our employees in universities and educational institutions, not just to those working on or funded by federal money. Robert Barrios, the professor of anthropology at Southern Illinois, whose talk at the John A. Logan Hispanic Heritage Conference was to be the highlight, was canceled without even consulting him to see if it did in fact violate the goal of the executive order. Critique is not an act of hatred, he says. It's an act of self-improvement, and that means history is not an act of hatred. One thing that a university education can do for us is to be a means of acquiring new skills to earn a good livelihood and good jobs. But the other important mission is helping develop future citizens who can think critically. The overwhelming majority of Americans seek to do the right thing, Barrios said. The challenge is that being ethical requires us to be able to think for ourselves. And in order to think for ourselves, we have to be given the tools to do that. Not all schools are so quick to comply with Trump's order, but many are nervous. The University of Michigan's president said educational efforts are critical to much-needed action to create equitable economic and social opportunities for all members of society, to confront our blind spots, and to encourage us to be better teachers, scholars, and citizens. And this is the basis of academic freedom. As Hank Reichman of the American Association of University Professors said 2 years ago when he was a guest on our program, the First Amendment guarantee of free speech is not simply a protection for a speaker to express ideas and beliefs. It is perhaps more important, protection of the right of people to hear, to listen to a wide range of beliefs and ideas. The power of the vote is transformed into a tool of tyranny if the voters have only partial information, only a single doctrine or point of view, only inherited or dictated ideas to consider. This is associated with what Trump wants to do to replace the innovative and prize-winning study of American history. I didn't put it in my script, and so it's escaping me, but we know what it is. And to replace that with a teaching program he wants to call the 1776 Project that would teach us all to be good patriots, which is not quite the same thing as being good Americans. Principal teaching within a pluralistic society can be like ballroom dancing in a minefield, considering that every student is a complex mix of ideas, beliefs, experiences, identities, and sensibilities. And some sizable chunks of American history illustrate how often we fail to live up to our ideals or how mistaken some of our assumptions have been. Our very vocabulary embodies a cultural past and contains words subject to multiple interpretations. And yet teaching under these awarenesses is more interesting, more stimulating, and more important to our individual and collective future than a rose-colored and sanitized version could ever be. Accordingly, a statement by the American Historical Association Association calls the executive order clearly a campaign stunt, deploying the legitimate background of the home of the nation's founding documents to draw distinctions between the two political parties on education policy, tie one party to civil disorder, and enable the president to explicitly attack his opponent. To learn from U.S. history, we must confront it, understand it in all its messy complexity, and take responsibility as much for our failures as for our accomplishments. Barrios said, the diversity programs are not liberal fluff. They're sometimes about death, life and death. For example, studying the occasion when church shooter Dylan Roof came in and slaughtered a prayer group. This is studying Dylan Roof himself. At one point, an uninformed kid trying to think about the history of his own nation. Denied a critical education about it means that probably the consequences will be tragic. So my main concern is that regardless of whether he wins or loses, Trump is in office until January, and every day he does damage like this, going into yet another critical element in our society, critical element in the way our culture is, we hope, evolving for the better, a critical way in which we function with one another, and trying to twist it into a propaganda device or a means of oppression, which is what this looks like to me. So I hope, I was trying to edit on the fly, and I know I was a little tongue-tied, but I hope it came through.
As usual, you've dug deep into this issue, and it always brings to mind this phrase, American exceptionalism, which is kind of drilled into the zeitgeist and the American psyche and notion that we should, I don't know what, forgive and forget everything else we've done and just be the shining city on the hill.
Yeah, and I have a lot to say about that, the word shining in that so-called quotation also. Yeah. As we always say, the shining city on the hill, but that's not how it was first uttered.
Scott, what's on your mind this morning?
Well, I think many of us are concerned about the threat of violence during the election and after the election. And, of course, the big news this week was law enforcement officials announced that they had charged 13 men with a violent plot that included storming the Michigan State Capitol and kidnapping Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Conservative groups have criticized Whitmer for her attempts to control the coronavirus by restricting normal activities. In April, President Trump tweeted, "Liberate Michigan." And apparently some of these same folks that were at some demonstrations at the Capitol in Lansing, Michigan, were there armed to the teeth. And some of these same folks were the ones planning this kidnap and murder plot, because there was discussion of executing Governor Whitmer. 3 years ago, the polling firm YouGov asked Americans whether they thought it could ever be justified for their political party to use violence to advance its goals. The overwhelming response then was no. Only 8% of people said anything other than never. This year, YouGov asked the same question, and the share saying that political violence could be somewhat justified roughly doubled. The increase spanned both Democratic and Republican respondents. I've read that statistic had been tamped down somewhat and adjusted for some reason, but still all very alarming when people are looking towards violence to settling political disputes in this country. And then you have another dimension to this problem where Barry County, Michigan Sheriff Dar Leaf, who was speaking on the steps of the Capitol with some of these coup plotters, these would-be murderers and kidnappers, really excused these guys. This is a sheriff in Michigan.
Right.
And that speaks to a larger problem in the country where you have all kinds of law enforcement making common cause with these vigilantes and militia groups. We saw that in Kenosha, Wisconsin, with that guy Kyle Rittenhouse, who murdered two anti-racist demonstrators and wounded a third. He's been praised by Republicans and Trump. So we have a crazy situation in this country where right-wing extremism has been embraced by one political party. White supremacists are responsible for the majority of extremist-related murders in the U.S. in 2019, according to data collected by the Anti-Defamation League. That's a continuation of a disturbing trend, with right-wing extremists
committing more than three-fourths of extremist-related murders in the country since 2010. And, I mean, there's a lot of statistics. I won't get into that. As we are very much aware, U.S. President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence have both refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power if they should lose November's election. That was really underscored in Mike Pence's non-response when he was asked that direct question in the vice presidential debate with Kamala Harris. When asked to condemn white supremacist group Proud Boys, Trump said to the Proud Boys directly in the audience, "Stand back and stand by," which they adopted as their new slogan. And of course, Trump, without evidence, points to Antifa and left-wing groups as the cause of violence across the country, and makes the same charge against Black Lives Matter. Just to really bring this to, I think, an important conclusion is that, in my view, Republican politicians must be forced to choose which side they're on, Trump's brand of failed fascism or democracy. GOP politicians must be forced to make a public declaration telling the American people if they're with the terrorist traitors or patriots and defenders of the U.S. Constitution. I think that's what we've come down to. And I'd like to see all these Republican politicians challenged to say what they believe in terms of this right-wing white supremacist threat.
Yeah, the question is certainly on the table. It's amazing that we've come to this. And, you know, that kind of leads into my slightly more macro view of where we stand right now. I'm kind of fascinated and horrified that we seem to be living in this kind of surreal bifurcated world or vision of what's about to happen on November 3rd. On the surface, the country is cruising along toward a perfectly normal election on November 3rd, right? The pundits are analyzing poll numbers as usual, prognosticating about what might happen 10 minutes or 3 weeks from now. Politicians are urging people to vote, the panacea in our exceptional democracy to any and all ills that need curing. But meanwhile, beneath this illusion of calm and normalcy, there's a horrifying nether reality, kind of like that show. I don't know if you saw the show, followed that show, Ruthann, called Stranger Things.
Yes.
Oh, you did? Okay, cool. So, you know, so this world underneath the surface, right, this calm surface with, you know, playful tween heroes is inhabited by poisonous snakes, slimy dragon-like beasts, and devolved Lovecraft monsters that populate the real world of our approaching election. And I want to refer here to this amazing article by Barton Gellman that appeared recently in The Atlantic. Barton says that the danger is not merely that the 2020 election will bring discord. Those who fear something worse take turbulence and controversy for granted. The coronavirus pandemic, a reckless incumbent, a deluge of mail-in ballots, a vandalized postal service, a resurgent effort to suppress votes, and a trainload of lawsuits are bearing down on the nation's creaky electoral machinery. Just to give some examples, which he uses in his piece, it's in the Atlantic, November issue of the Atlantic Online. He says, Republicans and their allies have litigated scores of cases in the name of preventing fraud in this year's election. State by state, they have sought, with some success, to purge voter rolls, tighten rules on provisional ballots, uphold voter identification requirements, ban the use of ballot drop boxes, reduce eligibility to vote by mail, discard mail-in ballots with technical flaws, and outlaw the counting of ballots that are postmarked by Election Day but arrive afterward. The intent and effect is to throw away votes in large numbers. And he goes on, and I guess I could conclude here by saying, the political system may no longer be strong enough to preserve its integrity. It's a mistake to take for granted that election boards and state legislatures and Congress are capable of drawing lines that ensure legitimate vote and an orderly transfer of power. We may have to find a way to draw those lines ourselves. And, you know, there's also this fear that there's all kinds of very arcane legal chicanery that the Republicans are going to employ to appoint alternate slates of electors that could go to Congress. And he actually maintains that there are several scenarios in which Biden could win the popular and the electoral majorities and still lose through the leisure demand of this legal manipulation by Trump and Pence convoluted constitutional loopholes. So this is anything but a normal election. And it's so bizarre to me that we do have this kind of double vision or bifurcated view of it. Oh, yeah, the election is coming. We're a democracy. One person, one vote. We're going to go and we're going to exercise our franchise and everything is going to be resolved and democracy will out. I am really not optimistic.
Well, Richard, we do have a guest on the line, and that's Shira Tarantino, co-organizer of the October 17th Stanford Women's March to Save Democracy. That's going to be happening 10 a.m. next Saturday. And that's, of course, not just in Stanford, Connecticut, but all across the country. There's more than 300 events, rallies, protests, and marches planned in 49 states all across the United States. And Shira, thank you so much for making time to join us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
So, Shira, lots to talk about. But first off, just tell us what's happening in Stanford, and if you're aware of some other events locally in our region here, give us just a few of the details, and we'll give some contact information before we say goodbye this morning.
Sure. Well, we are having our own version of the Women's March right here in Stanford, Connecticut. Our march is called the Stanford Women's March to Save Democracy. And like you said, it will be on Saturday, October 17th at 10:30 a.m. And we will be holding our march at the Stanford Norwalk Superior Courthouse. And that's at 123 Hoyt Street in Stanford, Connecticut. And we are plugged in with the national women's marches across the country. And we are building an exciting roster of speakers. We haven't released that yet because we are still creating it. But I am excited to announce that the person who will be opening up our march is feminist poet Nicole Caruso Garcia. And she will be leading us off. And we're really excited about it.
That's great. Tell us the objective of this march. People are probably aware of the historic march, the Women's March, that took place the day after Donald Trump's inauguration back in 2017, January 21st, I believe it was. But I was there, and you know, it was a crush of 500,000 to 1 million people in Washington, D.C., and a total of 5 million people all across the country. Really, it has been in the history books as one of the largest political protests in the entire history of the United States. And that was the way we began the Trump era. But tell us about the objective of this this gathering of people at 300 rallies and marches across the country this next Saturday.
I would say that our objective is to voice our horror and deep concern about the direction of our country in which it's headed. But not only that, but how women have shouldered the brunt of everything that's been happening in our country. You know, for instance, lives are at stake. We have 210,000 Americans who have died as a result of Trump's negligence and disdain for the American people. We have a president who is basically a traitor and in my opinion, a murderer. And women in this country are bearing the brunt, like I said, of multiple crises, which include this the COVID-19 pandemic. It also includes white supremacy and nationalism and economic disaster, a worsening climate crisis, and a family and domestic care crisis. You know, so from here to from Stanford to San Francisco, women are rising up to demand to rebuild our government, which has been, it feels like it's been decimated. And so we are marching in support of women and also trans women and people who identify as feminine to join together to get people to vote in record numbers, to get people to come out. And we will demand that every single vote is counted, and we must deliver our democracy from what's been happening these past 4 years. We've really suffered through this, you know, season of crises, and we've had enough. So we're rising up here in Stanford to take our power back.
My co-hosts Richard Hill and Ruth Ann Baumgartner might have a comment or question for you.
Ruth Ann, anything from you on this?
I just want to point out that the size of this of the march after the inauguration was possibly almost as big as the audience at Trump's own inauguration, by his account. And I know he's furious at the thought of another such march, again showing him up big time. And I don't mean to say that I think that the march was almost as big as his inauguration. We know it was huge compared to the piddling crowd he managed to assemble to mm-hmm. watch him take an oath on an alien book that somebody just happened to have. I'm very excited. I have passed my ability to march, but I'm joining a Zoom march on the same day, and I'm really excited about it. What's happened, as you very accurately explain, is a total ravaging of the whole American enterprise, and it has fallen disproportionately on women. So I guess it's up to us to fix things again, as usual. And I'm really grateful to the people who are organizing these marches.
I did want to ask you about the Supreme Court, because in addition to making sure every vote is counted and there is a free and fair election where the results are protected, I know that the focus of the Women's March nationally is great concern and activism surrounding the Republican Senate attempt to confirm right-wing judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court before the election takes place. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about your personal concern and how that might be addressed at the Stanford event next Saturday?
Yes, well, one of the reasons why we're having it in front of the courthouse is in honor of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and also out of concern for the open seat on the Supreme Court. And we actually, a couple weeks ago, after Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, we had a rally on the steps of the courthouse to demand that that there not be a vote. I believe that our senators should not legitimize this process in rushing through a new Supreme Court justice, and it's of such hypocrisy that Mitch McConnell and the GOP are trying to rush someone through to fit somebody into Ruth Bader Ginsburg's warm seat. I don't even know what to say, that it's other than it is extremely hypocritical of the GOP to try and rush somebody through. And the process itself is not a legitimate process, and we should be waiting until we have a new president in office in order to fill out the seat on the Supreme Court.
Shira, this is Richard speaking. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this issue of misogyny, which has dominated the American political landscape for, I guess you got to say, centuries. Mm-hmm. But even in this day and age, we could start with reaction to the vice presidential debate, where the minute the debate was over, there was all kinds of horrible tweets reverting to that same misogynistic view of women in politics and women who are demanding power and who are stepping forward to assume their rightful place in the leadership of this country. Can you comment on that and how this issue of misogyny still is so dominant in our political culture?
Absolutely, yes. Well, you know what? This is nothing new. It's not anything that should be accepted, but it's not new, and we should recognize that. Senator Kamala Harris definitely got a lot of pushback after the VP debate, but it was because of the fact that she is a woman, and I am very confident in that. But she's not the first person who has, you know, woman who has been running for office at any level who has received pushback. I mean, if you go back 4 years and look at Hillary Clinton, you'll get a taste of all the pushback that Hillary got. Whether you were for or against her, you can easily recognize the fact that people hated her, and they weren't really sure why they hated her. They made up reasons as to why they hated her, and there was so much vitriol. And it's not just Democratic women also. It is Republican women who run, who find this hatred when they step up to run for office, such as Sarah Palin. And even though I don't agree with anything that Sarah Palin had ever stood for, I do recognize the fact that she also received a lot of hate as well. Even if you compare her with, someone else who ran for VP, her male counterpart may have been, let's say, Dan Quayle, who was sort of a goofy guy, and she's a goofy woman, and they're both sort of at that same level. But people looked at Dan Quayle as kind of funny and goofy and silly, and he's like kind of clown-like. But they looked at Sarah Palin as an evil, vicious woman. Misogyny goes back a long way, you know, before that even. And it's ingrained in our society. And if I might just quickly tell my own personal story, it's not a political story, but, you know, like many women, I have had so many microaggressions, so many stories. Every woman has her own story to tell, but my story doesn't begin with me. It begins with my mother and her mother before then. Even before I was born, when my mother was 16, she was raped by her own father. And she tried to tell her mother, and my bubby, grandmother, in Yiddish, she didn't even believe her when she told her. And she, my grandmother, was afraid to tell anybody, and so she didn't say anything. And there is a, you know, we women live in a society where we don't believe each other, and we don't believe, and not just men don't believe us, but women don't believe us. No one believes us when we come out and say, hey, this is what's happening. Excuse me. And to quickly just get back to my mom, she had asked her aunt to take her to the gynecologist because her mother wouldn't even take her. And I think there's a sense of shame in women, especially back then when abortion was not legal back in 1961 when my mom was a teenager. Just imagine if she had become impregnated during that abusive relationship with her father. She would not have been able to abort her child. And there's so much misogyny surrounding just our everyday lives in the way that we make our decisions. And my grandmother made her decision not to say anything to anyone. And it's because of our society and the systemic misogyny that we live with day in and day out.
We're speaking with Shara Tarantino, co-organizer of the October 17th Stamford, Connecticut Women's March to Save Democracy. Thank you for that story, Shira. I think it illustrates for many of us who aren't aware of the kind of daily
struggle and battle that women have to deal with. I'm speaking for myself as a male, that there's so much we're not aware of. Then thank you for sharing that. I did want to ask you about the election, maybe a double question here. One would be, what kinds of recruitment are you doing at this rally next Saturday in terms of getting out the vote? And the second part of that question is, what is your worst fear? Richard was talking earlier today about just some of the real kind of traps that the Republicans have set to divert a free and fair election result being ratified. But what are some of your big concerns about what might occur on election day?
My worst fear. Well, when you reach your worst fear, there's always a worst fear after that. And I think that we've reached some of our worst fears already, and there will be more down the road if we don't elect a Democratic president right now. I do think that, yes, he will, President Trump will contest the election if he doesn't win. That's a given. He's so used to suing everybody. Of course, he's going to sue the United States. But we have a group of people who are willing to protest his contesting the election on November 4th, if that happens. We're hoping that all of the votes will be counted, and that we don't want to happen what happened in 2000 with Gore and the hanging chads, if you'll recall that, to happen now, even though there are some differences now in how we run things. But I can't pretend to be an expert on elections. I'm really just an activist, and as an activist, I want to make sure that my vote is counted. And so, yes, of course, I personally would take to the streets and say, "Hey, call my senators up and rally the masses and say we want to make sure that everybody knows that we live in a democratic society where everyone's vote should count."
You know, I did want to talk about the period after the election, and let's suppose that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are elected president. There's been a lot of criticism of progressive and activist groups after President Obama was elected in 2008, that a lot of these groups went into a deep coma. Sleep at the switch, and a lot of the pressure that could have been exerted on the administration, especially in those first 2 years when they had the House, the Senate, and the White House, that a lot of things didn't happen because activist groups just were absent. What are your plans, if any, to maintain your activism after this 2020 election?
I'm glad you asked. Complacency is our enemy. If we get used to something being so good and we sit back and do nothing, I fear that we'll go back to how what's happening now. We can't remain complacent. And one of the things that I had done with another group of women parallel to pinkwave.org is a friend of mine, Brooke Manuel. She called me up one day in the middle of the summer on August, at the beginning of August, and said, we have to do something about Donald Trump. And it was at the time when Donald was posting tweets about suburban women. And so we created Suburban Women Against Trump, and we're calling ourselves the SWAT team. Excuse me, I'm a little scratchy throat. Hold on one second. So we created the SWAT team, and our goal with the SWAT team is to gather the masses, get suburban women activated. And what happened on August 4th is that we created this private Facebook group, and it ballooned to currently almost 9,000 women. And so now we have a group of 9,000 women ready to activate. And we will no longer be complacent. We will make sure that at least the group of women that we have with us in support of democratic policies that are pro-women and pro-trans women, that we will no longer be complacent. And we will make sure that we will get people out to vote in every single election, not just the presidential election, but there's an election every year, and people need to know that voting locally is just as important as voting on the federal level for our federal government. And so we're also going to gear up for getting people out to vote for midterms when that comes due. And so there's no complacency in democracy anymore. We can't there's a sense of urgency, I think, that some people feel that others don't, especially women. I think that women feel a certain sense of urgency, especially right now that Donald Trump is in office, that we must do something. And so if we always feel that urgency, that we won't be complacent. I think the people that feel less urgent or less urgency are people that are a little bit more privileged, such as a white Christian male who has a different life experience in society than let's say a black woman does. So I think some people will naturally fall into complacency, while others will not. But in my group, both the SWAT team and Pink Wave, we will make sure, we will do our best to make sure that no one is ever complacent again in our society.
Ruth Ann, Richard, any questions or comments before we say goodbye to our guests?
I could ask you about SWAT, which is Suburban Women Against Trump. Stamford is a fairly large city in Connecticut, right near Westchester County. What's the demographic there, and what is the strategy for your group, which I guess consists largely of people who live in the metropolitan area around Stamford, the suburban area, to make it a diverse movement, a movement where black and Latinx women are involved and emerge as leaders in the movement? I'm not sure. Maybe they have already, but I'm wondering about that, because, I hear all this talk in the mainstream media about how, Biden is going to ride to victory on the backs of white suburban women. And I'm thinking, is that really what's going to turn the tide here? And that doesn't sound like a movement to me. That doesn't sound like a broad-based movement that's going to have the kind of carryover that you've been talking about in terms of following up on these macro issues and these intersectional issues about racism and economic justice. So I'm just wondering how you are navigating that issue of diversity in your movement there in Stamford.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that that challenge. First of all, Pink Wave is different than the SWAT team. They each have their own strategies. Our local group is Pink Wave, and that is Stanford-based, and that is extremely diverse. We have organizers who are black, Latina, and white, and Asian American. The SWAT team just happened. It organically happened on August 1st, August 4th, something like that, and it gained momentum quickly, and it's national. So the two groups have different strategies. Pink Wave's strategy is to be extremely intersectional. It's an intersectional feminist group. Basically, Pink Wave was born from a groundswell of all different types of women in Stamford, or the greater Stamford area, in Fairfield County, who march and rally for equal rights for women and gender justice. whereas the SWAT team is a national movement specifically geared towards deepening our getting in touch with the women who may or may not be decided in this election. And it's a national movement, and that is a different demographic and therefore a different strategy. And we are using both strategies to get people out to vote in this election. The SWAT team is, I look at it as a temporary way to get suburban women out to vote and to get them to talk to their friends who are fairly complacent, who, I don't know if I'll vote for Joe, I don't know if I'll vote for Donald. Believe it or not, there are a few undecided voters out there, or even those people who are registered Democrats but don't normally get out to vote in every election. We're trying to get people, every single person, out to vote. And so I think with a multifaceted strategy, we will be successful in getting a Democratic leader. Our goal is to get a Democratic leader in order to make sure that we have a Supreme Court that represents all of us and not just the few of us. And so we have to step back and also look at the bigger picture and make sure that we have, hopefully, maybe even we can flip the Senate. And if we do that, even if Trump loses and we have the Senate, at least we have some hold on our rights and our lawmaking so that we can all be represented.
You said this is a national movement. My sister just moved from New Jersey to Michigan, and she's always been politically very active. I think that this is something she would like to add to her pre-election activism, if not in an ongoing way, possibly. Do you know how to? Can you tell me how to contact the national movement, or is it many small groups that add up to national, or is there a national coordinating site?
We have two Facebook pages. One is actually we, meaning the SWAT team, because when I say we, I'm a lot of different things. I wear a lot of different hats. But the SWAT team is a private group of women, but we have a public Facebook page as well. So you can actually go to Facebook and type in the SWAT team 2000, and our public page will come up, and you'll see all of the events that we hold as SWAT team on that page. However, to be in the private group, you have to be invited by somebody who's already in the group. So that's a little bit more difficult. However, if you have a sister or a friend, you can send them my way. Send me an email, and then if she's on Facebook, I could friend her and then add her to the group. However, what we're really doing is telling people to go visit our public page, the SWAT team public page, because that's where all of the event information and action will take place. And I also just wanted to say that the SWAT team has been holding phone banking sessions for both local and national phone banking in support of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in order to get out the vote. We've also held some text banking and voter postcard writing as well. And with Pink Wave, which is our local organization, we have been doing local phone banks, and we actually have a phone bank coming up with in support of Johanna Hayes, Congresswoman in District 5 in Connecticut. And we're also it's the same night we're having our sign-making party, which is half live and half Zoom, because we are trying to mitigate the virus, so we're not doing a lot of live things. Most of the stuff that we're doing is on Zoom. And I'm going back and forth between Pink Wave and SWAT. The SWAT team is actually also going to hold a conversation in the coming weeks, but before the election, with Connecticut Senator Blumenthal and New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. And I don't have a date for that yet, but if you check the public SWAT page, SWAT Team 2000, we will post it when we have a date.
Could you go over the details for the event on the 17th, this next Saturday?
Yes, absolutely. The details are Pink Wave, Stanford Women's Talking Circle, the SWAT team, which is Suburban Women Against Trump, and Stronger Together Connecticut, which is a coalition of Fairfield County Democratic organizations, are partnering up with the National March, National Women's March, to organize the Stanford Women's March to Save Democracy, which is next Saturday, October 17th, at 10:30 a.m. on the steps of the Stanford Norwalk Superior Courthouse, and that's at 123 Hoyt Street in Stanford.
I do want to make a mention for people who live in other areas in our listening region. They can go to womensmarch.com, plug in your zip code under the October 17th drop-down menu, and you'll find out there are hundreds of protest rallies, demonstrations, vigils, and the like all across the country. That's womensmarch.com.
I also just quickly wanted to say that we were unsure of whether or not we would even have something like this in person because of the virus. So what we're doing is we got a donation. We have a sponsor. Our sponsor is Tutem Masks, T-U-T-E-M Masks, and they are donating 500 masks to our rally, and we'll have volunteers on hand to give out those masks to people who already don't have their masks. Mm-hmm. So this is a masked up rally, and we will be helping people to social distance themselves, so you can stay within the group that you've come, but stand apart from everybody else that you see there as much as possible. We want to make sure that no one gets sick. We don't want to become, a super spreader or anything. And if we feel that there are too many people that might come, we might cancel it. But that's not the case right now. I think we have some good numbers. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that we are very aware of the virus, and public health is number one for us above all else at this point.
Shira, thanks so much for spending time with us on Resistance Roundtable this morning. Appreciate it, and good luck with this event coming up on next Saturday.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
That's Shira Tarantino, co-organizer of the October 17th Stanford, Connecticut Women's March to Save Democracy.
And you have been listening to the Resistance Roundtable. This, again, is our last show before the election. I do want to mention that WPKN will have special election coverage on November 3rd. Scott Harris and I will anchor that, along with many other staff members from WPKN, including Ruth Ann, who will be helping out. And we'll have a roster of guests that you will not hear in the mainstream media. So that's November 3rd, starting at 8 p.m. here at WPKN. Resistance Roundtable comes to you the second Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. And so we will be back election week, and I imagine we will still be waiting to know who won the election. The suspense is mounting, folks, and so is the tension and the fear that this democracy has just too much weight and stress on it right now to bear up under this. But let's try to soldier through. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned to WPKN and Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and streaming online at WPKN.org. The show Barricada is next.